The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you look at how everything has played out, it just goes back to this interest in making sure that the CCP has ultimate power over everyone.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 8th, 2020. The protests in Hong Kong have grabbed international headlines, but Hong Kong is hardly the only region of China that is experiencing brutal repression from the Chinese Communist Party. The latest unrest in the city and the imposition of the new national security law in Hong Kong mirrors actions taken in Xinjiang, the province of China, which is inhabited principally by Uyghur Muslims. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio is a diverse group of experts on Chinese human rights issues in different parts of the far-flung state. Alvin Chung, a non-resident affiliate of NYU's US Asia Law Institute, is an expert on Hong Kong law. Jeremy Dom of the Paul Tsai China Center at the Yale Law School is an expert on Chinese criminal procedure and the detention of Uyghurs outside of it. And Sophia Yan, whose piano playing you are listening to right now, is the Beijing-based China correspondent for the London Telegraph. She has reported both from Hong Kong and from Xinjiang. It's a wide-ranging conversation. We talked about what's going on in Hong Kong, what's going on in Xinjiang, what's going on in Tibet, and what's going on in the mainland of China itself. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 8th, Xinjiang, Hong Kong, and China. Sophia, I want to start with you. The perception in the United States, or among a lot of people anyway, is that China is being super aggressive on human rights issues right now. The most visible, of course, is Hong Kong, but there is this long-running Uyghur detention issue in the background as well. Is that perception correct, or is China simply behaving the way China always behaves?
Well, these issues that you mentioned in Hong Kong and in Xinjiang with the Uyghurs, these are long-standing concerns that have been around for a while, for the last couple of years. And it's just becoming coming more into light, really, what's been happening. There's been a lot of reporting about it, of course, over the years, but more and more so foreign governments are starting to think more deeply about what these actions, while within the borders of China, might mean going forward. And all of this is coming also with the pandemic. You know, China has, in a very physical way, encroached into the lives of basically everyone on the planet. And so there is this sort of reckoning that's happening. China has never had a great human rights record by any means. Just the level of awareness of it, though, is certainly increasing. And under President Xi Jinping, he's the leader of the ruling Chinese Communist Party, ever since he took power in 2012, there's been a very widespread, quote-unquote, anti-corruption crackdown that has knocked out some of his competitors and rivals and kept in place people that he likes, his supporters. And as part of all of that is this much broader crackdown on any sort of dissent or any potential point of contention that could affect stability across all of China. Now you're seeing that expressed in really tangible ways. And the national security legislation in Hong Kong, for instance, is one of those.
Should we think of this as a series of discrete issues that an authoritarian government raises, i.e., you know, there's the virus response, which raises certain issues. There's the long-running Hong Kong set of issues culminating in the current national security law. And there's the repression of Uyghurs and a whole lot of other things as well. Or should we see it more as a unified set of policies and a kind of coherent single theme that runs through it?
So I would say it's a little bit of both. So it's coherent in the sense that all these actions are meant to uphold one goal, and that goal is to ensure that the Chinese Communist Party can stay in power now and for a very long time, to snuff out any sort of dissent and to tackle issues that might become one later on, this issue of stability. I mean, from the Chinese state's perspective, there can be no challenge to its authority. There's just no such thing. And they don't ever want to give this specter that they're weak or that they won't respond to anyone who is making such challenges. And so in that sense, it is coherent. But in terms of these policies on the ground, there's also a bit of disconnect. You know, the Communist Party is large. There's local level parties. There's, you know, at the province level, even down at city levels. And then there's also the overarching central government. So there's a duality, much like any other government. There are sometimes miscommunications and there's bureaucracy. I mean, there's also still politics, even though it is a one-party state. But again, when you look at how everything has played out, it just goes back to this interest in making sure that the CCP has ultimate power over everyone.
You are somebody who has lived in Hong Kong and also reported from Xinjiang on Uyghur detention matters. When you think of those issues, do you think of them as an extension of the same issue, or are they just very discrete questions in your mind?
Well, I would say this goes back again to what I was saying about keeping the Communist Party in power. You know, they're concerned about Xinjiang and Hong Kong because these are areas that have given them some trouble. I mean, there was interest in Xinjiang before to have more autonomy from China. There have been some acts, you know, there's been a lot of strife really about what Xinjiang's role is in general for Uyghurs. I mean, they've been under the thumb of the Communist Party. They've been suppressed in so many ways, and they want a greater voice. They want to be able to have certain freedoms. That's not so different than what Hong Kong wants, except, of course, Hong Kong was promised these freedoms when it was returned by the British Empire to Beijing. And so while on the face of it, they are very different places. Hong Kong is this very developed global financial hub. Xinjiang is landlocked right next to Central Asia. I mean, it's sort of in some ways no man's land. It's really hard to get there. You know, they're very different, separate places, but they go back to that one big question, which is in what way can Beijing bring both of these under its thumb and under control?
Alvin, when people are out demonstrating in Hong Kong, are Uyghurs in any part of their consciousness, or is that so far away? There is no consciousness of the fact, you know, of the relationship that Sophia just described for the average person protesting in Hong Kong. Does the plight of Uyghurs in Xinjiang even register in their understanding of what they're doing?
I think it really depends on who you ask. The Hong Kong protest movement has been a very big tent. It was a big tent even in 2014 with the Umbrella Movement protests, and it is even more so now. But certainly the plight of the Uyghurs and the Tibetans resonates with at least some of the demonstrators. When Andy Chan, who was a founding member of the now banned Hong Kong National Party, spoke at the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, he explicitly referred to the situations in Tibet and East Turkestan. And at the time, a lot of people thought, well, that parallel's rather fanciful, but they're clearly not laughing about it today.
Do you find it a compelling I don't know, I guess the chic word for it would be intersectionality, right? But is it something that resonates with you, or, you know, as somebody who's from Hong Kong, does it seem so attenuated that as to be effectively rhetorical and nothing more?
That's a tougher question to answer. At least at the moment, concentration camps are not being built in Hong Kong, at least not that I'm currently aware of. But certainly there has been a lot of commonality in the way that the Chinese Communist Party has dealt with peripheral regions, as it were. There's the same set of rhetorical devices, the same set of allegations of splitism or secession. And this extends to things like the imposition of quote-unquote national education, the deliberate erasure of local dialects and culture and the like. And one of the points that could have been made in the past and has been made in the past is, well, but the Hong Kong population is predominantly ethnic Han Chinese. But as of the imposition of the NSL, I can no longer say with confidence that that will be a meaningful differentiator.
Jeremy, how does the Hong Kong protest movement look to Xinjiang Uyghurs? Is this, I'm sort of posing the reciprocal question that I just asked Alvin. Is a Uyghur in Xinjiang even aware of what's going on in Hong Kong, or do they see it as a movement that is similar in nature to their own, or awareness but sense of distance from it?
Being outside of Xinjiang, it's hard for me to know what information is going on and what information is able to get through. Information controls have been quite tight there for a while. If you don't mind, I'd like to take a step back and follow up on what Sophia was saying about the general trend that is connecting these two situations, which I agree with absolutely everything she said. But I think the general trend that I would point to as well is a real shift in confidence of China that's been going on for over a decade at this point. And that shift has been from one of learning and trying to comply with sort of international norms to starting to assume a role in shaping them. And I think this impacts the assertiveness that you're seeing in Xinjiang and in Hong Kong as well. Of course, we don't have to look to these special sort of areas to see human rights concerns. There's plenty within the mainland as well in the last few years, including the roundup of lawyers and the passage of a new extrajudicial supervision law for regulating government officials. But we've seen in terms of these outlying regions, as Alvin was saying, a real assertiveness where China is trying to create its new model. In a human rights declaration from the South-South Convention, they even went so far as to redefine what the universal freedom of religion means by creating a corresponding obligation that comes with it, an obligation to assimilate. And we can see how that plays out in Hong Kong under the new policies there. Unfortunately, in Xinjiang, at least, the new model that's playing out doesn't seem very new at all, but is very familiar to those of us who've looked or lived in colonial countries, where there's a belief that they are uplifting the Uyghurs to make them assimilate into the mainstream culture. But I think Sophia is dead on when she says that the overriding theme here is stability, and that means stability and continuity of the party rule.
So give us a little bit of history of the Xinjiang repression and this kind of colonial quality of it. I think most people are generally familiar with the history of the Hong Kong protest movement, but Xinjiang, for a lot of people, the first time they ever heard of Uyghurs was when a few of them showed up in Guantanamo in the early 2000s. And the next time they heard of them was when the Chinese started putting them in concentration camps. And so what's a sort of sketch of the history of this conflict or colonial repression, or however you want to characterize it.
Yeah, I'm not a scholar of Xinjiang. I'm a scholar of Chinese criminal procedure. And so what I've been following is the more recent trends where China, under the banner of anti-terrorism, has begun crackdown movements, really restricting the individual liberties of the Uyghurs. There have been violent incidences. There have been both periods where the Xinjiang region was up in arms with ethnic tension and civil unrest. And there were also terrorist incidents outside of Xinjiang that really rocked the country that were linked to the Uyghurs. Now, what's happening, though, that's most interesting to me as a criminal procedure scholar is that what's going on in Xinjiang is outside of China's normal criminal process. They, rather than address it through the tools that are available, have created a system that it goes beyond their own laws.
And what do we know about the system? I mean, Sophia, you have tried to go to some of these camps, but Jeremy, sketch out for us the system that the Chinese have created and how it interacts with normal Chinese law.
So I think it's an evolving system. And I wouldn't count on our current understanding of these education centers slash camps still being where most people are housed. I think once that information became public and a subject of global criticism, many people were shipped out of the camps either into the mainstream criminal justice system or into forced labor situations, supervised labor situations around the country. We know that these camps did exist. We know that we don't know exactly how many people they contained, but the evidence is overwhelming that it was a mass detention by any standard. And what the legal system did is they went beyond even the very permissive counterterrorism law that China passed a few years ago, which allows for detention through the criminal process and even administrative detention, they call in China, where it doesn't have to go through a court, but short-term detention of up to 15 days can be allowed as an administrative punishment directly by the police. But they've gone beyond this and created a system of seemingly indefinite detention in these centers. And the way they've done that is, rather than call it a form of detention, they've tried to argue that this is voluntary. And I think, you know, that is hard to accept that premise, given the calls from relatives outside of Xinjiang to find their missing loved ones. And also the scale of the situation. But if you read the white papers that China has put forward on this, what it is essentially they found a way to funnel almost everybody who has not yet committed a crime, has already committed a crime, or even has already served a sentence, can be placed in these education centers for basically ideological education, to try and reform them into functioning citizens in the language of that's used in these laws.
Sophia, you have attempted to visit some of these centers. Tell us about your experience in trying to do this and what you were able to learn about their size and scope and what we really know about them at this point.
Well, it took me several days on the ground in Xinjiang to get anywhere remotely close to a camp. There's a lot of surveillance. It's in so many ways a testbed of what artificial intelligence plus all the advancements in technology now can mean in terms of policing and watching and monitoring people. So there are cameras everywhere. There's these facial recognition ones that I think I'm pretty sure is just one of many ways I was being tracked. There were some physical minders following on foot. I was traveling with a photographer. We would try to get in a taxi, for instance, and within a few minutes of getting in, somebody would ring the driver and ask where we were going. They would often converse in Uyghur, but the destination that we had given the driver would repeat to whoever had called, we think the police, in Mandarin, which I can understand. So there were so many ways to thwart reporting. I mean, this is not a unique experience by any means. Every foreign reporter that's gone to Xinjiang has experienced some form of this. Even from the minute I got off the plane and tried to exit the airport, we were stopped and asked for our passports and held for a while. Even on a layover, we were watched, you know, so you can imagine on the ground in Xinjiang, it's really difficult in terms of mobility to get around. And anyone you come in contact with, especially Uyghurs, might be harassed. In many cases, these people we were trying to talk to were very afraid. They were sometimes told not to talk to us. This is something that has been ongoing for a while, and it's just the Chinese government's way really to try to keep under wraps what's going on and to shape the narrative, because their line, their story, as Jeremy had mentioned, is that people are voluntarily going into these, quote, re-education camps to learn new skills, to get better jobs, to increase their standard of living, and that they're coming out fully formed and ready to contribute to society. In practice, the former detainees I've interviewed have talked about really, really horrific conditions, being given pills and not told what they're for, these body cavity searches, being beaten and tortured, even cattle prods, being electrocuted if you speak out of turn or you're not completing these assignments about the greatness of the Communist Party, for instance, if you're not doing them properly. There are hundreds, if not thousands, in each of these camps. I did eventually make it to one facility, and you could see that it had been built. We know this from satellite images that researchers have put together, but a lot of these facilities have gone up rather quickly in Xinjiang. And from what I could see, there were many, many windows. They had bars on them. And based on former detainee accounts, it's 16 to 20, at least in a room. So if you just look at some of these pictures that are available, including ones that I took, you count the windows, multiply by 16 to 20 people, and just look at the scale of the facility. I mean, it's just astonishing how many people have likely cycled through this. I mean, some of the estimates from foreign governments, including the U.S., put that number at up to 3 million who have gone through this very, very complicated, very challenging camp system that really tries people. I mean, it's just, it breaks your soul, is what people have told me. And you don't even have a chance to talk to your family.
Do we have any sense of how long people are staying there? So when you say 3 million people have cycled through, is this 2 days of detention, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years? I don't know why I just used the number two, but do we know anything about the life cycle of a detention?
From the reporting I've done, there seems to be a rather complicated system of different kinds of detention. So a person could cycle through the system potentially for years. Almost nobody's detained for just a few days. Once you're in, you're in. And some of the facilities are slightly better in terms of condition. And it seems based on who you pissed off sometimes and also how serious your crime has been deemed if it's gone that far. But it is fairly arbitrary as far as we can tell, we meaning the general public and reporters covering this and academics looking at this situation. There's also this forced labor system that has come out. So some people who have been deemed to be quote-unquote re-educated are being put in jobs in different factories. There's some sense that those factories might actually be in other parts of China now, not just in Xinjiang, because there's been so much attention paid to Xinjiang. And really, once you're in, that's it. You're in the system. They're watching you. They're watching your family. They're even watching your relatives abroad. There's been accounts of people who live in Turkey, outside of China and other countries, who have run into potentially Chinese agents trying to hush them, make them stay quiet about what's going on.
Alvin, presumably the Chinese do not aspire to create a similar situation in Hong Kong. There's a lot of reasons why they wouldn't necessarily want to do that. Among other things, because Hong Kong, though it has special status, which is very awkward for the CCP, there isn't really sort of an assimilation problem in the same way. And as you point out, Hong Kong residents are overwhelmingly Han Chinese, so you don't have the ethnic dimension. But the use of a, you know, complex network of detention and repression to pacify a restive population is something that I would think Hong Kong residents, after the national security law, would be foolish to ignore the prospect of completely. So how do you think about this system when you think about Hong Kong?
So to the extent that there may not be large-scale concentration camps and slave labor, I would say that, yes, there's the Xinjiang playbook will not be applied in full to Hong Kong. That said, I do think there is a significant risk of cultural assimilation in the decades that Hong Kong has been governed by a separate polity. It has developed its own distinct culture. Cantonese is the predominant spoken language in Hong Kong and not Mandarin. And one of the major planks of the imposition of the national security law is cultural indoctrination. Already we are seeing that public libraries are removing books from shelves. The Education Bureau is conducting quote-unquote reviews of all of its teaching materials. There have been calls to install closed-circuit television cameras in classrooms to snitch on teachers. So I would suggest that the extent of the crackdown or the details may vary slightly, but probably not as much as one might initially think.
Jeremy, do you think the Xinjiang model is exportable?
I don't think it's exportable to Hong Kong particularly. I've stopped being shocked by anything, but there's portions of it that are already all over the mainland. I would say what the Hong Kong national security law is doing is not so much bringing a Xinjiang type repression to Hong Kong, but bringing the mainland system to Hong Kong. And that not only is it sort of figuratively doing so, but it allows literally that to be done in some criminal prosecutions where mainland law can actually be applied in Hong Kong by central government actors. What's most surprising about the law is that it actually goes beyond even what mainland law does to persecute people outside of the country. And it's going to make it a very tenuous business model, not just for the Hong Kong people, but a business model for foreigners who are used to having sort of more of a free space to interact with China and to do business with as a hub for Asia in Hong Kong.
But what about exportable to Tibet? I mean, for Americans who were not particularly intimately acquainted with Chinese policy in Central Asia, Tibet and Xinjiang seem to have a certain amount in common. They're both, you know, periphery to the mainland or to the main body of China. They're both abutting, you know, Central Asia. They are both ethnically, or at least there's a majority that's ethnically distinct and linguistically distinct. In both cases, there has been a very concerted effort over a long period of time to bring Chinese, Han Chinese in as a kind of cultural elite. And in both cases, there has been local resistance, sometimes violent, and efforts to assert local autonomy or in some cases independence. Should we expect that the Xinjiang model gets applied in areas like Tibet?
I think to a large extent it already has. In fact, it may have gone the other way. Leadership from the Tibet area has been brought to Xinjiang to sort of try and clean it up there. They do share a lot in common, as you suggest, and that includes something they share in common with Hong Kong, which is this threat of foreign interference. In Tibet and Xinjiang, you see a fear of foreign loyalties, which might be behind independence movements. And even in a recent crackdown on corruption and organized crime, this in those areas has sort of mutated into a crackdown on people using religion to organize people, or even using local language to organize people to create alternative power bases to the party. Again, I don't think it'll play out exactly the same in any two regions, but I think what has been played out in terms of surveillance, education, and the idea of an obligation of the local peoples to assimilate to what the perceived majority culture is definitely playing out in both of those areas.
Sophia, how much of this is linguistic? Because one thing that actually, as Alvin points out, unites Hong Kong, Xinjiang and Tibet is language differences from Han Chinese. The Chinese government contends that Cantonese is merely a dialectical difference from Mandarin. I don't think there's a respectable linguist in the world that believes that Cantonese is not a distinct language, at least much, much further from Mandarin than, say, Swedish is from Danish. I'm not a speaker of either, but my understanding is they are not mutually intelligible. Uyghurs speak a Turkic language that is, you know, close to a variety of Central Asian languages. And of course, Tibetan is a distinct language as well. How much of this is the Chinese government really having an anxiety about any community that does not speak Mandarin and wanting to forcibly assimilate in a kind of Russian way, forcibly, you know, create a national culture that is Mandarin speaking and reasonably ethnically homogenous?
That's definitely, I think, one of the overarching interests for the party, also going back to that whole stability goal. You know, language for these places is really intertwined, especially in Xinjiang and Tibet, very much intertwined with local culture and historical traditions that have nothing to do with what Xi Jinping has been pushing, like a broad Han Chinese supremacy under the Chinese dream, under the wonderful umbrella of the Chinese Communist Party, which is what makes the grass green, the sky blue, and puts rice in your bowls. You know, like that's the line that they want everyone to remember. And if there are pockets in different ethnic minority groups, different languages, people who are able to gather and communicate and congregate and have some sort of shared experience, this is something that the communist state is really concerned about. I mean, that is also why they've been so big on a broader religious crackdown. You know, Chinese Muslims, Uyghurs aside, there's been a crackdown also that's affected Buddhists, that's affected Christians. You know, this is something that the government, the CCP, is so afraid of. And the one thing that the Communist Party seems to think will make an impact is this idea of education. It's been forced upon Xinjiang and Tibet. For instance, in Tibet and a lot of the schools, students are being instructed only in Mandarin Chinese, no longer in Tibetan. So after one or two generations, you can easily see a situation where that culture and that historical, that really rich cultural heritage gets completely wiped out. Arguably so, that's already been a very successful campaign in Tibet, and we're starting to see the effects of that in Xinjiang. In Hong Kong, that was a much harder sell. Every time the government tried to move towards a patriotic education curriculum to put bits and pieces in, there was always pushback. And now you're seeing that also go into this new national security law targeting specific, the idea that certain books, texts, for instance, could be illegal under the national security law and written in a very broad way as to target those. And so there's a sense, I think, from the Communist Party that people must be taught or forced to love the party, to thank the party, to have their existence so much intertwined with this belief that they would not succeed or have any sort of means of sustenance or living without the party. It's a very strong way to put that into a person's thinking.
Alvin, how important is Cantonese to Hong Kong? I haven't looked at data on this in a long time, but my recollection is that the number of Cantonese speakers over time has decreased very substantially under the party. You know, I'm curious whether you think a kind of war against Cantonese is part of, in significant part, will be part of an effort to subdue Hong Kong?
I think it will. We've seen similar initiatives in Guangdong province to suppress the use of Cantonese. Now, that will be more difficult in Hong Kong because, at least for now, Cantonese has the status of an official language. And on a day-to-day basis, it would be virtually impossible to engage in ordinary daily life in Hong Kong without some degree of Cantonese proficiency.
And just to be clear, Alvin, was I misstating it when I said that a native Cantonese speaker and a native Mandarin speaker, though they have a shared written language, do not actually have a common language that they can both speak?
There would be parts of each that may be intelligible to the other, but I would not necessarily put it much higher than that. And we've seen in the past that the party has brutally suppressed the use of regional languages like Shanghainese. And so I would not be at all surprised if there were a concerted effort to deprecate the use of Cantonese in at least the medium to long term, and perhaps even sooner than that.
Jeremy, I'm interested in your criminal procedure background or scholarship for this purpose. To what extent, I mean, when you say you're a scholar of Chinese criminal procedure, there's an implication there that that Chinese law actually means something, and that it will, in some sense, control and guide any behavior by the state. And yet, I do have this impression that they have these laws and then they operate entirely outside them whenever they need to. And this conversation offers a plethora of examples of that. So I guess I'm interested in your sense of what work law is doing in Chinese society as pertains to these communities, as well as to the main system in the mainland itself.
It's a legitimate question. First of all, I have worked with criminal justice scholars and criminal procedure practitioners in the mainland for a number of years, and there are people working very hard to try and ensure some level of justness in that system and to improve procedures for the accused at every stage, from police investigation through trial and enforcement of penalty. Obviously, it's not there yet, and I think most of us would not want to find us being accused of a crime by the Chinese criminal justice system. In fact, the idea of extradition to the mainland is one of the things that set off the most recent unrest in Hong Kong. And I was with some prosecutors when the protests began to the extradition law, and many in the mainland prosecutors, and many of them expressed that they could relate, that they would understand why that was. And in fact, as we've been trying to draw connections between Xinjiang and Hong Kong, my thought has been that the real overriding trend is of the mainland quest for stability. And these cultural angles, these language and religious angles, are really the local twist on that. But even within the mainland, what we see is this conflict between true rule of law, where individual rights are playing a limit to the party and state's power, versus the party's craving stability and being the only source of power. And it's the fear of what's happening on the mainland, which is not what the most extreme example, that I think it is what's most pressing and urgent in Hong Kong.
Sophia?
You know, in terms of how all of this has played out, there is some sense, I think, from Beijing that if there's a shared Chinese identity, that will contribute to the stability. And that's why this interest in having greater Mandarin literacy, this issue of culture and tradition. I mean, that's why I think you see a suppression of that, because it does seem that Xi Jinping wants to try to unite this great Chinese nation under this Chinese dream idea under the CCP. And so making sure that there's no room for anyone to sort of have a more unique form of expression or identity is tantamount to making that goal. The other thing I wanted to raise is that there is another similarity in terms of how things have played out with Xinjiang and Beijing, which is that in some ways the law came after the government had already acted. In Xinjiang, the camps were in place for quite a while. Reporters were covering it. There was a lot of work. Academics were finding these satellite images of these buildings, these facilities coming up seemingly overnight. There were the relatives of detainees with accounts of what was going on. The government, the Chinese government, kept denying it. They said it didn't exist at all. And then later, sort of retrospectively, legalized this detention system. In Hong Kong, also, something similar is happening. This national security law, in many ways, just sort of crystallizes and puts into legalese what we've seen occur over the last couple of years. We've had people disappeared forcibly, and from Hong Kong, there were these book publishers, five of them, in 2015, who disappeared from Hong Kong. One of them was actually disappeared from Thailand, and they resurfaced later in mainland China. Some of them were shown on the state broadcaster giving a forced confession. Foreign journalists have already been expelled. There was an FT editor who was kicked out of Hong Kong. And there were people who had run and been elected to the Legislative Council who were disqualified really for exercising their right to freedom of speech. But it was freedom of speech that didn't toe the Communist Party line. One of those people was Nathan Law, who's already fled Hong Kong over fear that this national security law would, that authorities would come right after him with this new law. And so in many ways, it sort of just justifies what the Communist Party was already doing in both of these places. And it gives them this fallback. I mean, China loves to say that they have rule of law and that they're simply following these their own enacted laws. They're following their constitution, that there's a process involved in putting something like this in writing gives them that kind of ability to say, hey, what we're doing is what we're supposed to be doing because this is in the law. Even though, of course, the law is can be pretty strong and quite draconian and sometimes really politically twisted.
And of course, if you, it's possible to call almost anything the rule of law if you combine super breadth of law with retroactivity, right, Alvin?
Absolutely. At its very core, the rule of law is about restricting arbitrary exercise of governmental authority. And it should be painfully obvious by now that the national security law, and all of those words should be in scare quotes, does the opposite of that. It's a blank check for the party and for the Hong Kong authorities to round people up, inhibit freedom of movement, freeze assets, engage in indefinite detention, and indeed much, much worse.
We're going to have to leave it there. Jeremy Dom, Sophia Yan, Alvin Chung, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our heroic audio engineer today, bringing together voices from Michigan, from Canada, and from Beijing itself, as well as me, is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by none other than today's guest, Sophia Yan. Our merch is available at thelawfarestore.com, and you should promote The Lawfare Podcast on social media and leave us a review wherever you found us. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.